The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
The world is in an economic crisis, and there are no easy fixes to our predicament. Unsustainable trends in the economy, energy, and the environment have finally caught up with us and are converging on a very narrow window of time. The sands in the hourglass are running out, and that's the topic of this week's FSN In Depth. Joining me on the program is Chris Martinson. He's the author of a new book called The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and the Environment. Chris, just a little background for many of our listeners who may not be aware of sort of the crash course. You were, let's go back to the year 2000, you're living a comfortable life. You're vice president at a Fortune 300 company. And then we go through the tech crash. And all of a sudden, coming out of that crash, things weren't operating the way they used to in typical business cycles. Give us some background in terms of the genesis of the crash course.
Oh, the crash course, Jim, it was a pure act of selfishness. I was just, like everybody, like a lot of people, I was very dissatisfied with what was happening to my personal 401k and personal portfolio. I grew increasingly discomforted with the ideas that were being offered to me and explanations offered to me by my broker. You know, stocks for the long haul, you know, volatility happens, all of this. And you know what I did? I started to dig into the data a little bit more, which, I got an MBA from a fine school. I'd been in business for a long time. But when I really started to dig into the economic data, I found some stuff that, frankly, it scared me. And I saw that it was unsustainable, just economically, just this first E, right? So here I am looking at the economy, and I'm looking at levels of debt. I'm looking at the entitlement programs. I'm looking at that point, what are really cute, tiny, fuzzy little fiscal deficits, but they seemed worrying at the time, you know, $300 billion, stuff like that, chump change compared to today. And when I came out of that little tour down this hole of data I fell into, I said, wow, I could see how this could really be unsustainable and fall apart at some time. And I didn't know when, but I knew that we were on a collision course of some form. And when I combined that with this other E called energy, that's when the story became really urgent for me. And so, yes, I had this very comfortable existence. I found some data, and I said, I have to make some really profound changes. And it wasn't, when I say I, let me be more clear. My wife and I made some very profound decisions. At that point, when we completely shifted gears, I'm 42. Vice President, I'm right where I'm supposed to be. I have a nice house. I got a boat in the slip. I've got three shiny young kids, and we had to make some really big changes as a consequence of what we found.
You know, our listeners, just think about the last 10 years. We began the last decade with the events of 9/11. We had the tech crash. We saw things in the environment that we hadn't seen in a long time. Everybody can remember Katrina and Rita. And then we had another crisis that began at the end of 2007 and 2008, and just the various crises that we've seen in the last decade. But Chris, as I look forward in the next 20 years, and as you write in your book, the next 20 years will probably, with a high degree of probability, will not look like the last 20 years.
Yeah, they're going to be completely different. And the reason for that is that the last 20 years, so in fact, you know, I picked 20 years because I'm sure the next 20 are going to be different, but actually it's the last 40 years I want to look at. So let's start in 1970 to 1980. Credit market debt more than doubled. 1980 to 1990, again, another doubling. 1990 to 2000, another doubling. 2000 to 2010, 4 decades, 5 doublings of credit market debt. Okay, so if we want the next 10 years to look like any of those last 4 decades, so 40 years, we want the next 10 to look like them, well, credit market debt has to double again, at least. Okay, so that means we have to grow from $52 trillion to $104 trillion of credit market debt in the U.S. alone. These are extraordinary sums. First of all, our glide path is really bad because we're nowhere near the $5.5 to $6 trillion of additional debt we would need to have taken on in the past year. You know, it just didn't happen. And so when we look at just that one component, we can say, look, over the next 20 years, the idea that we are going to double and then double again, total debt, requires us to believe in a story which says that we're going to have either fabulous, fabulous economic growth, or a story that says we'll have enough future growth to repay that level of debt accumulation. That story alone is just so difficult to have without some new transformative technology. You know, we need another railroad, another internet, steamerships taking over from wind, something. And A, we can't see that technology here in front of us right today. And B, when you break the story down, all growth comes from energy. Energy is the thing upon which everything else is built. Every economic whim, dream, and anything we do. And that's where the story gets really interesting, because we can clearly see all sorts of warning signs that we have not been able to grow energy on a net basis for probably 5 or 6 years now. Really, the net energy story is the one that provides a lens which can explain, possibly, you know, it could also be that this is just a bad correlation, but it looks pretty tight right now. We stopped being able to produce more conventional crude in somewhere around the year 2005. Give that a couple of years. Next thing you know, we have this big credit market break, and it looks like things just don't work the same, Jim. I mean, we've put trillions of dollars into the economy. We have interest rates at zero. Where's my growth, right? It's just not working right. And so in this story that I tell, what I'm trying to connect here is the idea that money itself was a perfectly useful tool to drive growth, control growth, manage it, dial it down, bring it up when there was sufficient energy. But as soon as you have insufficient energy in this story, all those same actions, interest rates, putting money in, all of this, it doesn't work the same. And that's what's fundamentally broken today. That's what Bernanke is missing. That's what most of the policymakers in D.C. are missing, is that the story has changed. Not that it's broken irrevocably and, you know, that this is going to be a horrible story and there's no way through this. It's that if we don't understand what the true nature of this predicament is, we will consistently be applying the wrong solutions to the right predicaments. We're just going to get it wrong.
You know, Chris, I first discovered peak oil in 1998 when I read a book by Colin J. Campbell. It scared the heck out of me, but then oil prices dropped to $10 a barrel, and I thought, okay, a little out there, so I didn't believe it. But then I discovered Matt Simmons, and all of a sudden I began to look into this. In your course, when you started looking at the debt levels and the economy, you discovered peak oil, and that sort of really broadened this picture of this kind of storm front that we're heading into. What has surprised me, and I don't know, you talk to a lot of business people, in the last, I would say, probably beginning last year, there have been a number of studies from the UK Task Force to Oxford University to German government, the U.S. military. Chris, it almost sounds to me like confession time, all of these reports coming out, and yet our leaders, our policy leaders, I remember talking to Robert Hirsch, who endorsed your book, and he came up with a presentation to all the presidential candidates back in 2008, and only one of them wanted to listen, and he neither got the nomination, nor is he president. Has it surprised you that nobody has listened to this issue, or at least at higher levels, or maybe they do know and just don't want to talk about it?
Has it surprised me? Yes and no. The no, because, you know, everything that D.C. does, that professional politicians do, that people who are in seats of power do, is, and I understand it completely, and I even did it in my own small way at a company, was the idea of preserving the status quo. I mean, this is what we do. This is how we're rewarded. This is how the structures are set up. This is what the incentives are. The real question here is politics, are politicians the right people to whom we should be looking for leadership on an issue which fundamentally challenges the status quo? And the answer to that one is no. And this is just, you know, I think it's just understanding how politics works. But there are fundamental elements of science here, and depletion, and how things work. You know, there was just a really excellent quarterly review by Jeremy Grantham. He also wrote a blurb for the book in praise of it, where he did a wonderful job, he and his team, of sectioning through really where we are in the depletion story, and whether you're looking at soil or water or minerals or energy. There's clearly some very serious warning signs there. They're scientific. They're quantifiable. We can debate the science behind them, but we can't debate the conclusions all that much. You know, little tight boundaries. Those are the discussions we need to be having. The reason I wrote the book, the reason I have my website, the reason that many people have started to come out with this story on their own is that politicians are not there yet on the story in the United States, nor should we expect them to be, because that's just not how our system is set up. It's kind of like expecting Goldman Sachs prop desk to, you know, give the right information to their client desk. You know, there's conflicts of interest in that story that everybody should know about and be aware about. And so I'm really of the mind that nobody should be waiting for politicians to come up with the right answer, to be honest about this, to read about it above the fold in the New York Times. Because by the time those sorts of admissions have made it to that level, we're going to be too far into the story for some people to make meaningful adjustments in their lives, their portfolios, their dreams, their plans, in order for them to really mitigate what could be some fairly disruptive, potentially, changes that are going to come. And that's the goal of the book. That's the goal of the work you're doing, I think, as well, and the goal of many other people out there who are saying, listen, it's time for us as individuals to look at the data, understand what it means, and make our own decisions. And by the time Washington, D.C. gets on board, and they will, it'll be too late to really do wonderful, effective, mitigative sort of things at that point in time.
Let's talk about this storm front, or I call it the perfect storm, and look at it from the lens of your book. And we're talking about three storm fronts, one in the economy, one with energy, and one with the environment.
Well, you know, we live in very interesting times. This is just, sometimes you get to live in periods of wonderful, calm history, and we happen to live in a period that I think is going to be fairly turbulent, because over the next 10 years, if we just sort of quickly summarize what's coming, we've got a demographic bulge in the United States, but so does Western Europe, so does Japan. There's a lot of the developed world that has the same sort of population dynamic, which is fundamentally rooted in the idea that all of us have had Ponzi wealth redistribution systems or Ponzi retirement schemes in place, which counted on more people working behind the people who are retiring. Well, that's not true when you have more people retiring than who are working. So we have a fundamental disconnect just on demographics alone. We've got more debt than the world has ever seen compared to productive capacity. We've got an aging infrastructure here that's all going to need fixing. And we are completely unprepared for a world of ever-rising energy prices. The United States has one plan. We'll call it Plan A. There's no Plan B. Plan A is we'll always have access to cheap fuel, liquid fuels in particular. Well, you know, anybody who's been to the gas pump lately knows that's not true anymore. You know, where we were shocked out of our minds at the first time gas went to $4, I guess we're numb. But here it is again. We're there. We're at record gasoline pump prices right now, or close to it, in most communities. And this is going to be not a temporary or a transitory condition like the Fed's trying to say. This is a relatively permanent condition. Could gas prices fall back? Of course. But over time, what we're talking about here is gasoline that was once 25 cents a gallon, then a dollar, then two, then three, now four. That trend is going to continue into the future, and we need to be prepared for that. And so when I look at all these fronts coming together, oh, and by the way, I guess another front would be, you know, 1.6 trillion fiscal deficits at the federal level. You know, all of these things are going to require vast resources, and they're all coming at due and asking for access to those resources in the very narrow window of time, which I'm calling the 20-teens. From now until 2020, there are so many multi-trillion dollar demands on our productive output that there's simply, the way I look at it, not enough to go around. And the question is, who are going to be the winners? Who's going to lose? What can we do? What can't we do? What are we going to be forced to prioritize, something we've not actually been forced to do on a political budget basis in a long, long time? And, you know, this is going to be fairly uncomfortable for a number of people.
In order to talk about these problems and the storm, Chris, I want you to talk about the concept of exponential growth. And let's begin with population, energy, and the money supply.
You know, there's a bunch of different types of growth out there. One is linear, you know, where we go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. But exponential growth says we go from 1 to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 8. And that exponential growth sounds like something that you know, oh, that's a special case. We'd study that in math class, but actually it surrounds us. So when we do something as simple as, here's this, anything that's growing by some percentage per year, anything, is growing exponentially. So you mentioned population. If you took a chart of population over time, say a couple thousand years, and you charted it, it would look like a hockey stick, right? It's growing relatively flat, and then boom, it gets steep. Well, population's only been growing 1%, 1.5%, some periods of time maybe 2% a year, but somewhere in that zone, 1% to 2%. And it's growing exponentially. Now, what else is growing exponentially? Well, what do we want from our economy? Well, we want that to grow 3% a year. That's not so bad, right? 3%. But again, because we want it to grow 3% every year, it's growing exponentially. And anything that's growing exponentially is doubling over some period of time. You know, it and this need to double, this, which is part and parcel of our economy, our money system, our energy usage, number of miles paved, anything. We have so many examples of exponential growth around us that it's something people really need to be aware of. And I spell it out in the book as best I can because it's really important to understand that everything we've done as a species, as a culture, as a country, is geared around this idea that we can do that forever. But there's a flaw in that story. Nothing can grow exponentially forever. You know, the universe is limited, our planet's limited, oil's limited. There's always limitations in there, but we've based everything about our hopes, our dreams, the futures, as if there aren't any limits. And so the real context of the story I'm telling is that over the next 10 to 20 years, we are going to be facing those limits. And we're already there in some stories. You know, this past year, they said, oh, you know, food prices have really risen because of, oh, it was bad weather. You know, there was floods in Australia, there was that fire in Russia, you know, something happened, right? Too much corn being turned into ethanol in Iowa. The larger context of that story is that we are running out of arable land. And the thing that you mentioned at the beginning of this, which is so critical, is that population is growing exponentially. Every single year we're adding between 70 and 80 million new humans to this planet. That's net new humans. Like some people die, some are born. Net new humans, 70 to 80 million. You know, across the globe that doesn't sound so bad, but how many New York cities is that? Five? Six? So 70 to 80 million new humans coming and looking for, everybody wants the same thing. We all do. I don't care what color you are, where you live. We all want the same things. We want comfortable lives. We want, you know, goods. We want to have, you know, recreation, all these things that we want. And that's really driving this story in a very, very big way when it comes to food, energy, water, fish in the ocean, all the basics. And this is something that's now in the next 10 to 20 years, this is something I'm going to be seeing in my adult lifetime. This is stuff my kids are going to be wrestling with. This is shaping the future. I used to write 4 or 5 years ago, I was writing about how the future was going to come. Well, the future has now arrived. It's here. We're in the middle of it. And this is something I want people to be aware of.
Let's talk about the problem of the money system that we live in. I mean, individual debt in this country has reached a limit. We've seen that since 2008. You just don't see consumers going out. I don't care if it's cash for clunkers or record low interest rates. We're not seeing the sustainable growth despite zero interest rates and all kinds of incentives. But in replace of that, Chris, what we've seen is the government step in, and the government is spending money like it's never done before. You mentioned earlier, this year we're going to face a $1.6, $1.7 trillion deficit. Last year was $1.3. They're talking about trillion-dollar deficits going on into your 20-teens. That's unsustainable. So let's talk about the role, because a lot of people, you hear this debate on television. Well, I know we're upset about the deficit, but had the government not done this, we'd be worse off. Well, the government can't do this forever because we don't have that kind of money.
Well, we don't. And I understand the arguments, and I'm sympathetic for the idea that that there's this sort of interplay between what consumers do and the government does, and that in times of consumer weakness, the government can step in and fill a limited role. But they've way overstepped that role in this particular case. So $1.6 trillion is overstepping that boundary in an enormous way. That is 10, almost 11% of GDP. I mean, that's just phenomenal amount of money. And my second critique around that would be, if we really were going to spend that much money in deficit, what are we spending it on? Are we spending it on consumption or investment? because it's a world of difference between those two. And frankly, almost all of that money has gone straight to consumption, not investment. And by investment, what do I mean? Taking the natural gas that we think we have in relative abundance for the next 10 or 20 years, put the pipelines in, do things with that gasoline, figure out how we're going to invest in the next round of energy technologies. You know, these are things that would be investments. And we're not investing with this money. We're just trying to get back to consumption. And so here's the model. I think it's a broken model, but that's my opinion. But the model here is that consumers are supposed to consume, and the way they do that is they take on debt, and we need them to consume more than they are actually earning. We love that model. Remember, you had your home, and it was rising in value, and you take your cash out HELOC or some sort of way of cashing out, refining, and taking money out of that, spending it. That drives the economy, and everybody's happy. Maybe we have credit cards. We've got student loans. We're borrowing for cars. That's the model we had, and the consumer, rightly and as predicted, would just started to retract when the recession hit. That's a good and normal behavior. What's abnormal in this story is the government stepping in saying, I see you guys were overspending and now you can't. Let me take on the overspending role for you guys. That's a broken model. Somebody lost the narrative in this story, which says that in a time when consumers are undergoing normal consumption and they have to retrench from that, the government can fill that tiny gap. When we're overconsuming and the government says, not only will I fill that, but I'll double you, that's where we lost the way. So, yes, people who look at these deficits and are concerned that they're unsustainable, as you mentioned, they're absolutely right on. They are unsustainable, but it's worse than that. It's how we are trying to sustain something that fundamentally any grade school kid could tell you is unsustainable. We are trying to sustain the idea that we can live beyond our means forever. And that's like the thinking caps have been taken off, and we're just reacting at this point. And clearly, when that story breaks, and it will, because things that are unsustainable have a way of building up until they stop. In that stopping moment, we might find that it's actually a fairly unpleasant consequence. And it's something that I worry about, and I know other people are worried about.
Chris, let's talk about that, too, because anybody that's done the math, if you just look at the government's balance sheet, which the government's fiscal year ends in September, and November they publish a financial report, you start looking at those numbers, or even the numbers that we have been discussing and you discussed in your book, 1.6 trillion deficits. We know when debt gets that large, there's only three things you can do. One, you could try to pay it back. Two, you simply default, as we've seen many companies do, and in many cases government. Or three, you print money. Now, anybody that looks at these kind of numbers, the kind of debt, as you mentioned, we've been doubling the debt every decade. And we're at $52 trillion now, not even talking about unfunded liabilities.
Right.
So anybody that does the math knows that this is unsustainable. So the path that we've seen throughout history is governments either default or they print money. And in that case, we could be talking about leading to hyperinflation. There's a big debate going on right now, and I'd like you to address it. One is, we're going to have deflation because we can't borrow, and we will pay back our debt, credit will contract, the economy will contract, and we'll have deflation, the dollar will be worth more. That's one camp. On the other side is saying, wait, these numbers, human history, what politicians have done in the past, we're probably going to end up printing our way out of it, and as we've seen, we've had QE1, QE2, and as of last week, QE 2.5.
Yeah, I'm calling that QE sorta. You know, we'll have that where he's going to. Bernanke said he's going to roll the maturing MBS paper that comes due into treasuries, and so we'll continue that. But this is the fundamental question, and this one I think has been more wrestled with on the internet than any other set of issues: inflation or deflation. I am currently completely unaware of any single example of deflation happening since August 15, 1971. That's when the world was essentially jettisoned into a floating exchange rate standard across the world when Nixon slammed the gold window. So the final tether between paper money or fiat money and some physical backing, whether it's gold or sheepskins, doesn't matter to me, but it was gold. And since that point in time, every single instance has been an instance of inflation that I'm aware of. So many of the people in the deflation argument camp say, listen, this is what's supposed to happen. This is what should happen. Let's go back to the 30s. Let's understand how that happened. But in the 30s, we were under essentially a bimetallic standard in the United States. Gold was the principal money, but silver was still there and in circulation. I call that a bimetallic. Some people say it was a gold standard. Room for debate on that one. But we were under a gold standard. I see how you get deflation under a gold standard or any fixed standard. But when you have the capability to hit a key, you know, on your computer, dink, and create four more zeros at the end of a string with no cost, it's hard for me to understand how deflation can happen given, you know, how easy it is to print and that it can happen at no cost and that there's no moving of physical gold and there's no accounting that ties back to something solid. That's point one. And point two in this story is the idea that deflation is an enormously destructive event. So think of all the institutions, the people, the careers, Bernanke, all the people sitting around the table at the Fed, but all the people in all the institutions that would be destroyed by a deflation and all the political and personal professional power they have. In order for us to believe that we would allow, I'm putting quotes in the air around now, allow deflation to happen, we have to believe that the people who are currently holding the reins are going to allow the destruction of political systems, of institutions, maybe of dissolution of portions of the country. I mean, a deflation at these levels of debt, I believe, would be such a destructive, such a whirlpool event that it would really seriously do what Hank Paulson was, I think, in closed-door sessions we've learned about since, was warning Congress about, this will end in martial law and anarchy. Maybe he was engaging in a bit of hyperbole there, but the idea is central, which is that deflation would be a monumentally destructive event. And if we could avoid that, even in over by delaying it a little bit so we've avoided it happening today, that's one sort of incentive for people. Or maybe we could avoid it altogether by just getting inflation to the right amount. That's a second incentive because we can sort of think that maybe we can dodge that bullet. There are so many things lined up that what we know about humans, what we know from history, what we know about how people behave, what I know about how I personally would behave, all lines up to the idea that hitting a key on a computer and putting four more zeros on the end of something is a lot easier decision to make than risking the potential uncontrollable effects of deflation. And against all of that, I would say there's one final powerful piece that really supports this whole idea that we would go down the inflation and deflation path, which is that you can't tax deflation.
Well, let's move on to probably one of the big storm fronts that we're all facing as consumers, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners, and even those that don't believe in peak oil. I mean, I've seen stories, and I don't know what it is about anchors on the cable stations can't seem to understand why we're paying $4 outside those evil oil companies. But let's talk about peak oil, because you're right. One of the things that we've seen in those stories that have come out over the last probably 18 months is, why is it we have been unable to increase conventional oil production since 2005? We're using other liquid fuels, biofuels, nat gas to liquids, coal to liquids, all kinds of other things to give us our liquid fuels. But when it comes to conventional oil, Chris, I'm unaware of any study that has come out in the last 5 or 6 years that says, oh, look there, we're increasing conventional production again.
You know, the last great region of conventional production, I think this is going to exactly encapsulate and hopefully illustrate the point you're making here. The last great area of conventional oil production, of course, in the world is the OPEC nations, and principally those in the Middle East. And the head of the IEA just this past week came out and, if I could use this word appropriately, begged OPEC to increase production, saying, could you please, you know, it looks like we need more production. And we have this bizarre set of things that are very hard to line up in this story with the head of the IEA saying, OPEC, please increase production, and Saudi Arabia saying, we're actually dialing production back. The markets are oversupplied with Brent crude at 124 a barrel or whatever it was at the time that statement was made. And it's not lining up. And so in one world, you try and line it all up, market supply and demand, and, you know, Saudi Arabia's acting rationally and all that, and it's just a really hard story to get your head around. And then there's another story which you can put on which says, actually, for whatever sets of reasons, Saudi Arabia is currently at max production capacity, which is not 12.5 million barrels a day. It's less than 9, potentially. And that OPEC rather than being this huge spare buffer with 5 million barrels per day under its belt of spare capacity, is actually running a fairly lean operation with relatively little. It's a story that all of a sudden makes sense, because when we look at oil prices in the face of relatively tepid demand growth and economic growth, when we look at the price of oil, when we look at all kinds of things, we get a story which supports exactly what you came up with, which is that conventional crude, the cheap, the easy stuff, and not just that, the grades of conventional crude that we first went after. Tap two wells, one's got light sweet crude in it, one's got heavy sour nasty crude in it. Guess what? We pulled all the light sweet stuff out first. That happened in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. And guess what? There's potentially an oversupply. I think Saudi Arabia's right. There is an oversupply of crude, but it's not the stuff we want. It's heavy, it's sour, it's the wrong grades. There's not a huge market for it. We'll develop a market for it, but there are so many warning signs that light, sweet, conventional crude has already passed peak, and we get that from statements, we get it from prices, we get it from bizarre behaviors. We can line all of these up, that I think it's time to admit that there's a very high possibility that the fact that the peak in conventional crude and condensate production was now 6 years ago is a very important sign, and we should be really heeding the warning signs and adjusting a lot of things in accordance with that.
Here's a problem, because you hear this from politicians, you hear it from the media, everybody's talking about in the next 10 years we'll be energy independent and green technology, energy technology is going to set us free and make the country independent again. And I'm just taking, if you do, you have in your book a title of a chapter, and in it you talk about simple math. And I'd like to just read a few of these for our listeners, because I don't think they grasp the concept of how much our world that we live and inhabit depends on fossil fuels. But let's say that we could go to alternatives. Well, number one, it would take 6,800 nuclear reactors running at the same efficiency as the 104 in the United States to make up. Or, if you're in green energy, it would take 6 million new 1-megawatt wind towers, 13 million acres or 20,000 square miles of land of solar panels, or if we want to rely on biofuels, 16 billion acres of farmland converted from food to producing biofuel. Chris, anybody that would try to argue rationally that we're going to be able to do that in the next 10 years is insane.
I agree.
Or can't do math well.
I agree. And, we don't have to do a lot of hard math. I think, we can get a crayon and a napkin and we're good. And I put those numbers out there simply to illustrate the idea that even if we magically had cars that could run on electricity, and we don't, right? Almost all vehicles operate on liquid fuels at this point in time. So the idea that we could just sort of like pave over, in essence, so many tens of thousands of square miles with solar panels and take that electricity and run our lives in the future in the same way we're running it today is missing out on enormous issues around time, scale, cost of what's involved in making such a transition. History's clear. When we transition from wood to coal or from coal to oil and from oil into natural gas, all of these transitions, they take 40 to 50 to 60 years. And there's a very good reason for that. The idea, the fantasy, if I could be so bold, that we're going to transition seamlessly and without disruption from oil into these other alternative technologies, many of which, by the way, I enjoy, I am bullish on, I support, I have both fingers crossed, I love them, I am not a detractor. But what I am saying is that the idea that we are going to seamlessly go from here to there without some fairly significant major disruptions is, I think, a complete fantasy. We have simple math working against us here.
Yeah, because, in the future, we do know that nuclear power, coal, alternative green energy is going to play a role, but I don't think, as many think today, that this is going to be the silver bullet that we could say, aha, it's going to be wind, or aha, it's going to be nuclear power or some solar panels. Eventually, maybe it may evolve solar energy, because as you talk about resource scarcity, eventually we're going to run out of things like coal and other kind of natural resources. Let me move on to something that I think is very difficult to grasp. And that is, given the last century, we have seen new technology bring us products that people could have only dreamed 150 years ago, radio, television, the internet, you know, space travel, jet travel, iPads, smartphones. We live in this technologically driven society. And in the back of the mind, oh, technology-wise, we'll just invent something to replace it. Why, in your opinion, is technology not going to get us out of this fix right now?
Well, technology has never done one thing, as magic as it is, and I love it all. Biotechnology, I mean, it's phenomenal what's happened in the past 150 years. And as a past scientist, I'm in awe of it, and I support it, and I'm actually passionate about what we can do. But there's one thing technology's never been able to do, and that's create energy. It can transform it beautifully, it can use it more efficiently, but it can't create it. And what we're fundamentally facing as we go forward is a new condition in the human species. We've never globally ever faced something that I think we're about to face in the next 20 years for sure, maybe in the next 10 years, possibly even in the next 5 years. Never faced this before. We will have slightly fewer units of energy available to us next year than we had the year before on a global basis. This is such a profound condition because that energy, it drives our economic growth, and our economic growth allows our money system to operate the way it does. And when our money system operates reasonably well, everybody's happy, and when it starts to break, all sorts of things break. You know, in the 30s, when our money system broke, look what happened. We had the most productive workforce in the world. We had natural resources in the United States that were off the charts. We were a net creditor nation. We were a net energy exporting nation. Everything was there except the money. Well, in this story, the one that I'm telling, there's a risk, a chance, something that people should mentally, physically, maybe even emotionally prepare for, is the idea that when our energy can no longer support the type of growth we fashioned all of our institutions around, most critically our money institutions, our money system, our banking systems, our financial systems, all of that, our political systems even, when the energy is not there to fund its growth in the way to which we've become accustomed, things will change. Possibly very disruptively, maybe not. But I think that the chance of disruption is so high that a prudent adult, a prudent person would look at it and say, you know what, I'm going to hope that everything turns out well, but hope alone is a terrible strategy, so I'm going to take some prudent actions, and I'm going to, you know, maneuver myself into this story. And the thing you raised is such an important point. So many people have looked at technology and seen what it's brought, and in some cases have mistaken the idea of what technology can and can't do, sort of mixed them up a little bit. And I got to be clear about this. Technology cannot create energy. It can transform it. And here's the thing. We need more energy. And if technology can't create something we need more of, that's the fundamental disconnect here. And yes, technology's great. It's just great, and I love it. But we've got to be clear about what it can and can't do.
All right, let's move on to the final E, which is the environment. Let's talk about something, as you just briefly mentioned there, that we're not used to, and that is resource scarcity. And I'm not just talking about energy. I'm talking about precious minerals. I'm talking about topsoil. I'm talking about water. Let's talk about the next E.
Well, in this story, you know, the environment for me, the part I focus on in my work is around the things you mentioned, which are around the resources themselves. And in this story, I mean, the mineral story is very clear and obvious. You know, we are now currently chasing mineral yields. That is, you know, what's the percent of copper in the ore body that we're looking at? It's been falling steadily over time. And that makes sense, right? You know, as humans, what we would do is we go out and scan the landscape. We're going to produce the most productive mine first, the one that has the most copper that we can possibly get our hands on. And this, you know, we'll call this high grading. And this has happened across every mineral we can think of. So we've already, in only 150 or 200 years of industrial revolution, you know, living in industrial economy, depending on where you date it, in only those 200 years, we've already basically gone through all of the best grades. And in the case of minerals, these are not renewable resources. These are not things where we can, you know, suddenly find a way to get more out of the ground, because, you know, we're going to be more clever about it. They are fundamentally not renewable. Once you've gone through all your 10% ore grade, it's gone. Now you have to figure out how to wrestle with a 5% ore grade. And when that's gone, you're down to the 2%, and so on. In just 200 years, we've basically gone from finding giant pure nuggets on the ground to where we're chasing stuff that's measured in the partial percentage points, you know, 0.2%, 0.1%, things like that. So that's minerals. Well, we've even done the same story with what many people would consider renewable resources. So that's the fish in the ocean. That's the soil. You can always rebuild soils, I guess, and things like water. But even in the case of water, we look at it in places like in the Southwest, where we're tapping these what we might call ancient aquifers or fossil aquifers. There is water that took tens of thousands of years to get down to these aquifers that are now being depleted at rates of 5, 6, sometimes even 8% a year. Remember back to our conversation of exponential growth. When you deplete something at 8% a year, it's the same dynamic as if we're growing something else at 8% a year. It's an exponential function. We are pulling down water that takes tens of thousands of years, around which we fashioned whole cities, ways of life, golf courses, investments, everything, and food production. And we've done all of that with something that on the surface kind of looks renewable. Hey, it's water, right? It falls from the sky, but the way in which we're using it makes it a non-renewable resource. And the non-renewable, the part of this story that's thoroughly unsustainable, is the idea that you can continually grow your use of something that is fixed in supply and depleting. Water fits that bill. Soil now fits that bill. The oceans fit that bill. There's a whole story here that says, hey, we're going to have to wrestle with an actual limit, if not now, pretty soon.
Let's talk about the timeline for this. You call it convergence, where we're going to see peak oil, a peak economy, and a peak environment. Let's talk about that time frame. You call it the 20-teens.
Right. And that's the part of this that actually generates personally inside of me the most urgency, the most concern, is the idea that it's not just one of these trends that we're going to have to wrestle with. So if all these economic trends were converging on the 20-teens, I'd look at that and bite my fingernails a little bit and say, I got some planning to do, right? Because, you know, we have the demographics we talked about. We've got the unsustainable fiscal nature of the United States economy and federal spending. We've got, you know, the debt growth pieces. You know, there's things there that just in that first year we would go, ooh, I'm concerned a little bit here. But when we put in the peak oil story and when we think that's likely to hit, my preferred timeline for peak oil arriving on the international scene is around 2013 to 15 at the latest. It could arrive even earlier. But by that, I mean full-on international recognition of the idea that peak oil is real. You and I have come to it. Companies have come to it. Small countries have come to it. But you know how these things work. Eventually, there's a tipping point, and I think that tipping point is no later than 2013 to 15, and that's right in the 20-teen basket. And then with the environment as well, as soon as peak oil is recognized, we get to peak lots of things in this story. And what that means is that energy is so essential to extracting minerals, to growing food, to pumping water from great depths, to trawling the last vestiges of the ocean. These sorts of things are also very energy dependent. So this is the convergence I'm talking about. Not just one, not just two, but three mega trends, economy, energy, the environment, all converging into this one spot. And I put that out in my book with a lot of data, and I hopefully do it in a very non-emotional, just very clean, clear way where I say, look, here's the data. And a lot of people do respond to it, and the most consistent response I get from people is, well written, I love the book, but you haven't told me anything I didn't already know in some way. And that's really what this book is about. It's about collecting stuff that's been out there. There's a lot of these disparate pieces of information. But I put them in a spot, and when you see them all in one spot, it's very, very hard to argue. In fact, I have not yet received a single substantive data-based argument from somebody who says, here's where you're wrong. Sometimes I get belief-based arguments. Oh, no, you're undercounting human ingenuity. Entirely possible, but here's my data for why, you know, as ingenious as we are, technology can't create energy. It's a critical concept. So I put these concepts into a spot. People look at them, and very often what comes up next for them is to say, oh, I knew it on some level. Thank you for making it a little bit clearer for me. Now what? And that's the part of the story where, you know, we're in the unknown because we've never faced this particular convergence of trends before in human history at a global level. So there's a lot to this story that's unknown. And God, I wish we knew more, but you know what? It's going to be a very interesting ride here.
Let's talk about, in your book, you lay out three possible scenarios. The first, a slow tumble. The second, peak oil recognition and a hard landing. And third, the undulating plateau. Briefly speak to three of those because we're running out of time and I want to talk about how to prepare.
Right. So, you know, what I try and do is frame up some future scenarios that I think are at least detail-rich enough that they're plausible. And so, obviously, there's a million ways this could all go. But, you know, one of the things that I'm really worried about on this converging timeline is that there could be some sort of a hard landing. That is, that the pace and the scale and most importantly, the urgency, the speed with which this thing breaks could be something that really provides more disruption than many are ready for. So the hard landing scenario says, you know, there's some, you know, peak oil suddenly arrives on the international scene in like 2 weeks. There's a doubling of oil prices over maybe a month and a half or 2 months. You know, the dollar suddenly has a bad moment, or treasury yields have a bad moment over the course of just a couple of months or something like that. By a hard landing, I mean a really fast, sudden, jarring change to the landscape, the economic landscape. And in that process, you know, what we would expect would be a fairly significant set of disruptions for people who are fundamentally unprepared in their portfolios. You know, a slow tumble to me then is another scenario where, you know, we have basically a slow tumble is kind of like what we saw from 2008 to now, right? So we had oil prices run up really high July of 2008. By October of 2008, we had a financial crash. Some people said, well, hey, did it have anything to do with the high oil prices, like the last six out of seven recessions? The answer is probably yes. You know, that was a pin that stuck that particular bubble. But we recovered. We poured trillions in, and there's been a bit of a recovery. And now we're back over $100 a barrel. Maybe that provides the next pin. So a slow tumble is this idea that it takes a couple, several years between each one of these events. But 20 years later, we look back and we go, wow, we lost a lot of ground. And so that's another scenario that I really flesh out, because it's probably the most likely one to me. An undulating plateau is one which is just a little bit longer than the slow tumble. And that's one where there's some interplay where high oil prices cross over from a rising economy, and then one plummets and the other follows. And we just sort of go along that path for a much longer period of time. There's a lot of evidence. We've been in an undulating plateau for conventional crude since 2005, so that's sort of the basis for that scenario. But here, the point of putting these scenarios down is to just get our thinking around what might these different futures look like. Ultimately, that's what the book is about. It's just trying to peer into the future a little and say, here's what might happen and what feels true and what do we do about it.
All right. Speaking of what do we do about it, let's talk about what our listeners could do to prepare.
Well, you know, at the larger level, the good news is I think we already have everything we need. We still have plenty of energy. We don't need any more information. We don't need any new farming practices to be developed. We don't need any new technology. We have everything we need at this point to make substantively good and better decisions around what we're going to do now in the future. We'll have to reprioritize. We'll have to do things a little bit differently, but we can lead perfectly wonderful, full lives with what we've got for a very long time. Attempting to preserve the status quo, sustain the unsustainable, get us to continue to overconsume, I think that path ends badly, but that's my opinion. So given the idea that, you know, we talked about earlier that politicians are going to come to this game late, if ever, I think that individuals, corporations, companies, communities, it's incumbent on them to look at this data, look at this information, and begin to make the plans that make sense for them. And in every case, I can simply boil it down to one word. Everybody should seek to become more resilient. Resilient. Resilience is the ability to recover from an insult. It's the ability to heal. It's the ability to draw from more than one source in a time of insufficiency from another area. By resiliency, what I'm asking for other people to do is what I've done in my own life, which is become more resilient with respect to the energy and how they consume it. Simple example, when I bought this house I'm in, we only had oil heat in the basement, and that was it. If we had oil, we had heat. That's not very resilient. It's a single point of heating, and it's not economically resilient. Certainly, oil prices have doubled for heating oil since I bought this house. But the first thing I did is I put in a wood stove. I put solar hot water panels on the roof to heat our water with sun instead of oil, and insulated and did things, meaning that I now consume and am exposed to less than half of the oil consumption that I used to be without any change to my lifestyle. And so I'm now more resilient. Energy prices can rise all they want, and they only hit me half as hard as they did just last year. And so that's an example of resilience at a very, very micro, small scale. That's me. But we need to start thinking about those things at the larger levels, our communities, our companies, our neighborhoods, things like that. But absolutely, just become resilient with respect to food, water, energy. Those are the basics at the bottoms of the pyramid. Everybody should be doing those, and you can do them. And I'm a living example of one thing, which is you can not only do them, but you can have a good time doing them. They're satisfying. They're fulfilling. It feels good. It feels right. I sleep better. There's relief involved in all this, and you spend less money over time, even though there's a little investment usually up front. So there's lots people can do. We have a whole What Should I Do series at our website that details a lot of this at chrismartinson.com. Ideas in the book about how to get started on this. There's no one-size-fits-all manual for this because all our circumstances are different, whether you're 18-year-old in the Southwest or 90 years old in Maine. You know, it's very different circumstances. But the concept is there, which is it's time to become more resilient.
When you talk about this, what you're talking about, Chris, is a giant paradigm shift. And for a lot of people, that's going to be uncomfortable. Number one, it's going to be disruptive. We like things the way they are. As you talk about, so much of our political system, economic system, is based on maintaining the status quo. But on a positive side, you know, you're going to need to develop, number one, new skill sets. New specialties will be developed, and I think the biggest paradigm is going to be for the economy and all of us as a whole is instead of managing for growth, which was, you know, you go get a MBA, what do they teach you about? How to manage growth, how to run a company, how to grow sales, how to grow revenues, how to grow profits. Managing for a world where resources will become scarcer and more precious. And so, you know, it could be a good thing. Instead of maybe a service economy, we move back to manufacturing, and the manufacturing is local. So instead of outsourcing and shipping the jobs overseas, we bring the jobs back home and bring them locally. So, Chris, you know, as dire as some of this stuff may sound to people listening to this interview, there's a lot of positive messages. One of them, as you talk about in your book, we already have the things that we need to get through this. And number two, there's all kinds of things, new skill sets, new opportunities, new things that you can do. And I mean, if you make your home more, you know, let's say, Chris, you and I are wrong about this. Well, if, you know, your house is run by solar, your energy costs are down in half, you're growing some of your own food, you have water sources, are you going to be any worse off for it? I don't think so.
No. And I'm really glad you raised that the point here, which is I understand why when people sometimes encounter the story that I'm telling in my version, but other people have told it in other ways, they look at it and they go, ooh, that's doom and gloom, or it's something. It's uncomfortable. And I totally understand that, because what we're really talking about here is a story of change. And for some people, they look at change and they think of that as loss. And as humans, we're just wired badly for loss. We hate it. We avoid it at all costs, right? And I get that, and that's completely normal. But in this story, if you can get it, and you can get it in time, it's just as much opportunity as it is challenge. It has just as much new that we gain as we lose. And that's the part that I'm trying to really open people's eyes to, is what is going to change here? What's new? What's different? So let's imagine we have somebody in the financial services industry. Well, guess what? Somebody who's been in the industry who has been essentially their job has been to put people into index funds. If the story I'm telling is right, that's a losing proposition over time, because what they're going to be doing is putting people into things that will only behave well and return expected returns if there's a story of growth. Wow, that sounds like a loss. Gosh, you're telling me, you know, the financial services industry is going to wither. Like, no, part of it will, and the part that will arise are the people who can help people get into the directed investment opportunities that are going to flourish under this new regime. And there are many of them. And so this is an equal opportunity story where there's some things going away and some new things arising. And the people who can get to there just a little bit ahead of time, I think, have an advantage. Certainly people who got into the gold and silver story when you first started talking about it are at an enormous advantage. People who saw the peak oil story have done extremely well over the last 10 years. People who can see this story, I think, are going to be better positioned. Not that it's an easy story, not that there's not going to be a lot of uncertainty. There'll be some chaos. There'll be many things of, I think, a high period of volatility that will be pretty devilishly tricky to navigate. But hey, we got to do it. So that's my story here, is that there's big change coming, and I find it exciting because I actually like periods of change, and I think there's a lot of opportunity in here. And yes, I'm also aware of the fact that there will be an element of loss, an element of change, an element of challenge, and maybe even disruption that also exists in this story. But that's what comes with change, big period of change. Next 20 years are just not going to be like the last 20 years.
Well, Chris, you've done a fabulous job at taking your crash course and putting it to print. And your book is definitely on my top 10 list for the year. The name of the book is called The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and Environment. And may I suggest this? Do yourself a favor and pick up a copy. It may be the most important thing that you read over the next decade. And we've been speaking with its author, Chris Martinson. Chris, once again, job well done, and it was a pleasure to have you on the program.
Jim, the pleasure's been all mine, and thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Financial Sense News Hour with Jim Poplava. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell securities. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the opinions of Jim Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerances. You should always consult a qualified financial advisor before making investment decisions. Financial Sense will not be liable to anyone for financial losses resulting from companies profiled or information provided on this program. The Financial Sense News Hour was produced by Steel on Steel Productions. Join us again throughout the week for more in-depth news and financial analysis at financialsense.com.